You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's governor is sharing his thoughts on where he'd like to see Wisconsin go in the new year. Coming up, we'll see what he thinks about another statewide mask mandate, criminal justice reform, redistricting, and his potential Republican challengers in 2022. We've got a WPR reporter talking with us just ahead. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has pushed us into unknown territory. We don't know how long we'll have to stay away from family or friends, or how long kids will be in and out of school, or when this will finally stop being a crisis. Our next guest says she's learned how to deal with not knowing from sled dogs. Blair Braverman and her husband, Quince Mountain, have a sled dog team called Braver Mountain Mushing based in northern Wisconsin. Blair is a dog sledder who ran the Iditarod in Alaska in 2019. She also races closer to home. Blair is an author, and she recently wrote an article in the New York Times. It's called What My Sled Dogs Taught Me About Planning for the Unknown. I spoke with her last month about that piece. Blair, I hadn't thought of this until you opened your piece with it. When you set out with your sled dogs, they don't know how far they have to run. I mean, it seems so obvious now. What does that mean, though, for your dogs?
It's true. I think that's one of those things, like you said, that you wouldn't think about it, until you're really working with these dogs closely. But, you know, sometimes we go out for a 5-mile run. Sometimes we go out for a 500-mile run, and the dogs don't know. I mean, they have context clues, right? Like if there's a lot of people watching, usually we're in a race, and that means that we're going to go for a longer journey than if we just leave out of the yard at home. But they don't really know, and they don't know, you know, even in a race, we could do 10 miles and then rest, or we could do 60 miles and then rest. And that's the hardest thing. I always think, you know, sometimes I think, oh gosh, if they could speak English for 5 minutes, I could explain so much to them and we'd really be on the same page. But of course, that's not the fun of it. The fun of it is figuring out how to communicate, despite having very different ways of seeing the world and interacting with it. And the biggest challenge with the dogs not knowing how far they're going to go is that they love running. They want to run, and therefore they don't pace themselves. They run as if they just get to run as hard as they want, and then they get tired. And, you know, but obviously you'd go faster if you're going for 20 miles than if you're going for 100, just like you would with a human. So that's a kind of negotiation we have to do with the dogs where I'm like, okay, trust me, guys, like, you want to take it easy here. And they're like, ugh, you're such a drag.
Now that you've described that situation, what do you see in how we're moving through this pandemic with that context of what you see from the sled?
The main thing when you're taking a team of dogs out for a trip of any length, you know, not one day, but let's say it's going to be a multi-stage race or a multi-stage camping trip where you're camping and sleeping along the way and you're really going on a long journey. You have to front load rest. You have to build in rest that the dogs don't even want because they are ready to keep going. They, you know, maybe you're going to run 30 miles and you as the musher decide, okay, we're going to camp right here. There's a nice river. There's some water. I'm going to build a fire. You know, the dogs think that is so boring because they still have energy. They're not tired yet. They want to keep going. You know, and they don't totally get a choice. Like that's where I come in as the musher is, you know, people always think, how do you get the dogs to run? How do you make the dogs run? And they don't realize that so much of our work as mushers is the total opposite. It's really getting the dogs to stop. It's getting the dogs to rest. It's helping them to maintain a pace that's going to be sustainable for them and make it so that the whole trip, however long that is, stays really fun the entire way.
Talk more about front-loading rest, forcing your team to rest, and why you make yourself and the dogs take real breaks even when they don't want to.
You can't really force them to rest. You know, as they say, you can lead a horse to water. But I have some photos from the team I've taken where you set up the best camp, like you put out straw beds, you give them a nice meal, you heat up the meal in your cooker, and it's really like, you know, steaming raw meat, which is disgusting to us, but they love it. And they, you know, you put on their little coats because they sleep in coats and under blankets, and they will just stand and stare at you and be like, we are not taking a nap. This is boring. We like running. you know, so you can't make them sleep, but you can make them wait till at least some of the other dogs have had a chance to sleep. It's kind of like little kids being like, I don't want to go to bed. And you're the parent and you're like, yeah, like, I know you think you don't want to, but look, you're just going to be happier if you have a bedtime. And the trick, of course, is always to stop before they feel tired. You know, you always want to leave them wanting more. And then they start to learn, like, okay, even if we want to keep going, look, Blair's got the straw out. She's got the blankets out. She's taking off our booties. I guess I'll humor her and sleep for a couple hours because I know that I get to run again.
Blair Braverman is a dog sledder and an author. She lives in northern Wisconsin, and she's written a piece in the New York Times about learning to live with uncertainty through sledding. Thank you for being with us here on the Ideas Network. Blair, there's this moment that you talk about when you discuss the fact that rest builds trust. Will you read that part of your essay for us?
Yeah, absolutely. A sled dog learns that by the time she's hungry, her musher has already prepared a meal. By the time she's tired, she has a warm bed. If she's cold, you have a coat or blanket for her. If she's thirsty, you have water. And it's this security, this trust, that lets her pour herself into the journey, give the trail everything she has without worrying about what comes next. You can't make a sled dog run 100 miles. But if she knows you've got her back, she'll run because she wants to, because she burns to, and she'll bring you along for the ride.
That description just hit me. There's real beauty in feeling like somebody's there for you.
That's why I'm hooked on the sport, honestly. I mean, that's why this is so addictive. People go out for a dog sled ride. You know, I went out for the first time when I was 18 years old, and that was 14 years ago, and which is amazing to me to think it. This has been part of my life for so long. And the dogs are so joyful, and you get to experience with them. You get to experience wilderness with them. You get to experience adventure with them. You get to follow them over the course of their lives as they learn. And then in return, they take you on these amazing journeys. And just the depth of the love is extraordinary.
I can't help but draw the parallel to the pandemic. And I mean, I know I've stretched myself too thin over these months. And it's those places and those people that I trust where I can feel calm. That's what has made it better. Do you feel that?
Absolutely. Well, in this case, we're living through this thing that's very difficult, and we don't know how long it's going to last. And, you know, of course, the difference is that sled dogs have physical limits. They can't run forever, but they like running. And I would say at least the very vast majority of us do not like living through a terrible global pandemic. You know, if even if we haven't been affected, even if we're not grieving firsthand, we're living in vastly different circumstances. But what I've learned from the dogs is that you don't have to know how long something's going to last in order to take care of yourself in a sustainable way as you get through it. And the trick is you have to take it easy. You have to build in rest. You have to take care of your physical health. You have to take care of your mental health, because whatever you encounter on the way, you're going to be in better shape to deal with it. I can be very ambitious. I want to do everything with my dogs. I want to do everything with my writing. You know, and in this case, living with the stress of the pandemic, I have to remember to take quiet time, to build in chances for my soul to rest, so to speak, where, you know, I'm just existing. And the dogs help with that. They help with that a lot. But they also inspire me in that regard.
I mean, we're in survival mode, right? And we can take that for granted when our basic needs are met. And when they're not, you advocate for things like not looking too far into the future, not thinking so much about the unknown, but you suggest, like, eat a nourishing meal. Why do you think we should recognize that there's value in that?
Because the truth is, no matter how much we worry about the future, we won't know what it is and we won't be able to change it. it's so much worry that the only thing it brings to our lives is negativity and difficulty and pain. You know, if you're an epidemiologist or if you're doing something like that, or a medical professional where it's your job to think about the future of the pandemic, then of course that's a very different position to be in. But for those of us who aren't in that position, what we need to do is take care of ourselves. We need to take care of our loved ones. And, you know, that of course also means not putting them at risk, staying socially distanced, being patient, and finding ways to make this existence sustainable and even, you know, even strengthening. Like, what do you need? Do you need to read books or talk to your friends or make art or, you know, take up some strange sport or hobby or watch a lot of TV shows? Like, whatever it takes to sort of be okay in the moment rather than just pushing yourself and pushing yourself on and counting on some future point where, you know, everything will be okay then.
What do you say to someone who thinks there are so many big problems and there are so many things that I need to do that that kind of care feels superficial?
Well, it is superficial, you know, and it is in the moment, like you're resting in that moment. You're feeding yourself in that moment. I don't know what superficial really means in that case, because my job and my challenge is to let go.
You're listening to a conversation with sled dog racer and author Blair Braverman from November. In just a minute, we'll hear the rest of our chat about the lessons learned from the trail and how they provide Blair some perspective in this pandemic. This discussion continues here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We're learning some lessons alongside Blair Braverman. She's an author and she races sled dogs. Blair talks about coping with a lack of control and developing trust and the importance of rest. They're among the lessons she says she's learned from her dogs. Blair wrote about resilience in the New York Times, and we caught up in November. Let's talk about literal rest. How important have you found rest in mushing and in everyday life?
Well, when you're on the trail, the dogs are resting roughly 50% of the time. You know, we call it a 50-50 run rest schedule. So maybe you run for 6 hours and then you camp for 6 hours and you run for 6 hours and you camp for 6 hours. It's not 9 to 5. Like, you could be running at 2 in the morning and you could be sleeping at 2 in the afternoon, but the rest is there proportionately. The trick is that when the dogs are resting, the musher's usually working very hard. They're melting snow, they're building fires, they're doing all these things to sort of keep everything going. And so as a musher, you can end up getting very little sleep yourself. As the musher, you think, well, I can do this. I can do this. Like, I can push myself, and that's my choice. But the challenge is to make sure you're taking as good a care of yourself as you are of your dogs.
You write, it's far easier to prevent fatigue than to recover from it later. As you look at how we are dealing with the pandemic, do you think we've missed our chance to prepare ourselves, to give ourselves that rest we need for the long haul?
Oh, absolutely not. I think it's never too late, right? Because we don't know how long this will last. It comes back to that. But it's never too late to take care of your basic needs. If you haven't been resting a lot, you can start resting a little bit more. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. Take things a little bit easier. You know, have a meal that feels nourishing, and whatever that means for you. If you're really busy and exhausted, maybe that means you get a plate of frozen lasagna and you put that in the oven and it's still like a warm meal. Maybe it means you're like you love cooking and you're going to make some elaborate thing from scratch. It's what sort of gives you energy when everything in your life is sort of taking energy away. You have to figure out how to take care of yourself.
We're talking with Blair Braverman about what working with her sled dogs has taught her about resilience and strength. This is the Ideas Network. Blair, I understand you're maybe a bit of a reformed planner. It's frustrating because it can feel like we don't have a lot of say in what's happening in our lives right now. Do you think that we can plan and try to account for everything? How do we reclaim that sense of control?
Oh my gosh, I used to be such a planner. I used to you know, I knew how everything was going to go. And then I got into dog sledding more seriously. And, you know, of course, that all went out the window because there's so many variables. There's so many variables in dog sledding. You know, and of course, the metaphor is right there. There's so many variables in our everyday life, too. The idea that we can plan and account for everything is really just sort of a comforting illusion we hold on to. But for me, the trick has been to shift from the idea that I can plan for things, that that's what will make me prepared, and instead try to think of it as, if I take care of myself, if I am prepared in sort of basic ways, like I, on the trail, that means I'm learning different skills. I'm really building up my skills with making fires in weird situations and things like that. In life, it could mean something different. Then I don't need to know what will happen because I trust my future self to be able to handle it when it comes.
Speaking of the unknown, you say sometimes your dogs know more than you do. Like when?
Oh my gosh, so often. I mean, think about pet dogs that you have. They have all these instincts we can't even imagine. They have all these senses we can't imagine. So they know, you know, if there are animals on the trail, if a moose was there, or I mean, I can see if there are footprints, but I can't smell it on the wind. You know, they know, they understand the weather differently than I do. They understand the texture of the snow. They hear things. And those are all instincts that I can't even begin to imagine what that's like. So I have to sort of let the dogs translate it for me. I'm paying attention to where they're looking, where they're smelling, you know, their body language, their posture, the amount of energy sort of that's pouring out of them. I trust them. I trust them to, you know, to be honest in the sense that they're telling me what they have. They're giving me what they have, and I'm doing the same to them.
Some people take issue with sledding with dogs. One of the things you posted on Twitter is that responsible mushers are trying to make the sport better, to take care of your own dogs and also other dogs. How are you doing that right now?
Well, how am I doing that right now is it's what I've built my life around. You know, the way I think about it, I think mushing is so fundamentally good. I think the dogs love running. I think that having a bond with dogs is, you know, so valuable for them and for us. I think being in wilderness is so good for us. There's all these things that are just a fundamental good. And it doesn't mean that everything that's always been done around mushing has been good. But my challenge and the challenge of the mushers that I'm close with and I care about is to do what we can to honor that good and to really bring it out and to take the best possible care of our dogs that we can and try to represent that, try to raise awareness, do whatever we can to just make sure that, you know, the dogs are allowed to be dogs and they're allowed to be joyful and they're allowed, you know, when they get old, then they're allowed to rest. Like everything that they need, we sort of take our cues from them. People are always saying, oh, how do you, at what age do you retire dogs? And it seems like such a silly question because we don't retire them. You know, they sort of announce to us. It's very clear to tell whether a dog wants to do something or not. It's not a mystery. If you've been around dogs, you know, they make their opinions clear. And so we just have to listen. You know, if there's a dog who wants to run 30 miles a day at age 10, that's so wonderful. Like we have a spot for that. And if they want to retire and hang out in the garden, that's great. We have, you know, we have like toys and stuff and they can hang out with their friends. And we just try to honor that as best we can. And I try to never be set in my ways. My goal is just to do right by the dogs. And I do the best I can. And I will always keep doing the best that I can.
It's almost too obvious, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What is the parallel there then? What are you learning about taking care of yourself?
Oh, I am so much harder on myself than I would ever, ever be on the dogs. And that's been, that's the challenge. I listen to the dogs in a way I don't listen to myself. You know, like if a dog tells me they're tired, I'm never going to say like, oh, keep running. I'm going to, you know, we'll stop. Or that if it's one dog and not the whole team, the dog can ride in the sled. But if I'm tired, I'll try to push through. You know, if I'm sick, I'll try to push through. And, you know, I had Lyme disease a couple years ago and I got really sick. And part of what was hard about it is that I was so resistant, I think, so terrified of what it meant to rest, you know, for months at a time, that I beat myself up for what my body needed. when really it's sort of a neutral, like if you need rest, you rest. And the dogs are good at that. And I am less so, but they teach me.
In those moments that creep up on us, when it just all feels like it's too much, where do you find the strength and the will to keep going?
Well, the dogs. I think my favorite thing to do with them when we're not running is to sit down on the ground. And the speed at which they can lick your face is truly astonishing. But they're chasing each other and they'll jump off me, and it just like I sort of forget about all of my problems. And I do that basically every day, but it never fails to bring me perspective about what matters is where I am right now. What matters is taking care of the people, by which I mean dogs, that I'm responsible for, and finding moments to feel happy, even if the big picture makes it hard to feel happy. The little picture is still right there.
Blair, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am totally honored.
That was dog sledder Blair Braverman. Blair and her husband run Braver Mountain Mushing in northern Wisconsin. She wrote about what working with sled dogs teaches her about living with the unknown. You can read her essay in the New York Times. We've set up a link to it at ours. It's WPR.org/Central Time. I spoke with Blair in November. Coming up, 2021 is looking like it'll be a consequential year for state politics. We are finding out what Governor Evers has to say about the pandemic, the state budget, redistricting, and more. We've got WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief on deck to talk with us and help us understand what he learned in a year-end interview. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network. Is weird. There's no getting around it. Few would have believed that fans of Korean popular music would be a driving force behind fighting police brutality and white supremacy, but that is exactly where we are. Why we should care about K-pop is coming up today on 1A+. It starts at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. And 2021 is shaping up to be a pretty interesting year in state politics here in Wisconsin. Leaders have to craft a new state budget, which, in addition to fiscal matters, typically contains a good deal of non-fiscal policy. Plus, they need to draw new legislative maps. And of course, there's COVID-19. All of this is happening with another 2 years of divided government. And with Governor Tony Evers halfway through his first term in office, expect the state Republicans' push to unseat him in 2022 to pick up steam. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. Thanks for being with us, Sean.
Hey, Keeley.
It's been a pretty wild and unpredictable year. We will get to some of that, but remind us what we thought we were going to be dealing with in 2020.
Oh, man, where do we begin, right? Life as we once knew it, I guess, is what we were expecting. And just thinking back about like the stories that we were talking about in February of 2020, which is, you know, typically a busy year in an even year in Wisconsin state government. There was a proposal by the governor to call a special session to invest a projected budget surplus in schools. And that was countered by a Republican plan to put the money into tax cuts instead. There was this big debate. I remember doing like a dozen stories on it, I think, over extending bar hours during the week of the Democratic National Convention, which we thought we were going to have. And, you know, there was just like state government normalcy in February. And actually, just looking back at WPR.org and doing a search for what we were talking about back then, there were like four stories that mentioned COVID-19 in that month. And by March, there were 348. So that's kind of how life changed quickly for, I guess, all of us in the news world you know, and in the world at large.
You talked with Governor Tony Evers recently about 2020. Evers says he's optimistic that we'll eventually return to some semblance of normalcy. Let's take a listen.
My crystal ball is a pretty simple one. I hope to get to a Brewers game sometime this summer, even if it's in August in person. And so that gives me an idea that people are still going to have to stay at home, wear a mask, do the social distancing thing, and get vaccinated when your time is up.
What more does Evers think that we need to do about COVID at the state level to get us back to that, you know, normal?
Well, I mean, of course, there's the vaccine distribution, which, you know, we're learning about now, and the DHS, the Department of Health Services, is starting to track now and, you know, publish that information along with other COVID-19 statistics. But to some degree, it's going to be continuing to do what we've been doing. And you heard him mention it there, masks, social distancing. And so even though 2021, we hope, is going to be a different year than 2020, and that the vaccine will help us in this fight against COVID, I think you can kind of expect some of the same arguments that we had this year in terms of what degree of government intervention should there be when it comes to requiring stuff like social distancing or masks, and to what degree, you know, should people be allowed to make those calls on their own.
What did Evers have to say about the way his administration has confronted the pandemic?
His basic take is that they did about as well as they could, given the circumstances, and that he was happy for the way that the Wisconsin people kind of met him on dealing with the pandemic. His administration had its second Safer at Home order struck down by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And after that ruling, Evers did not take nearly as drastic measures as far as state government stepping in to, you know, require business closures along those lines. He did issue repeated mask mandates, and he did issue, or his administration issued, a more limited restriction on business capacity. But, you know, that after the Supreme Court stepped in, the court made it kind of clear that his powers were not as broad as he had interpreted them, or his administration had interpreted them to be. So he said that given sort of the restrictions that they were under, he thought that they, you know, they did all right. And he thinks that, you know, he knows that people say the mask mandate doesn't work. He's aware of the criticism, but he thinks that it's made a difference and that you have more people wearing a mask now than you would have if you had not had that mask mandate.
Talking with Sean Johnson, who's Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief, and we're looking back at 2020 and ahead to 2021 after Sean had a conversation with Governor Tony Evers. Sean, let's shift gears to that two-year state budget. That's going to have to be addressed this year. What do we know about what might be in it so far?
Well, what we know is that it's not going to be as that the fights will be different because the revenue is not going to be where it was a couple years ago. You know, that you're probably not going to have an argument over how to spend repeated, you know, projected budget surpluses, because the more pressing argument will be what to do with less revenue than, you know, the state's hoping for. So just kind of on a broad scale, I think that's what you're going to see with the governor and GOP lawmakers, is how to work together in that atmosphere. They didn't have to do that last time. Republicans passed a budget. The governor said he didn't like it, but he mostly signed it anyway. They won't have kind of that luxury this time around. And we don't know the hard budget numbers yet in terms of what the state is going to be projected to be working with. The nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau will come out with revenue estimates in January that'll kind of set the table for the whole budget process. But, we do know that agencies are asking for more than they're going to get. And, you know, the governor in our interview, he didn't say how much he wants to spend in schools. Obviously, he's a former state superintendent. He's proposed big increases in school spending before, and so that's one of his priorities. But he did allude to them not getting everything that they're asking for.
It's also a big year because we have to deal with new legislative maps. Republican lawmakers and Governor Evers have different views on how to approach that. Where are they coming from?
They are coming from, polar opposite points of view on this. And when Republicans drew the maps in 2011, they had the benefit of a Republican governor to sign whatever they drew up. And that's what happened. They took power of state government after the 2010 Republican wave, kind of perfect timing for them. And it let them draw maps that helped them hold and grow their majorities in the legislature for the past decade. What you have now is that the governor is proposing he has this People's Map Commission, which is holding hearings and is going to promote its own set of maps. I think those are probably going to be drawn around a different set of goals than what Republicans are looking at. You don't have to have been a long time state government observer to know that those are going to be likely rejected by Republican lawmakers, and that there's a very good chance whatever they send to Governor Evers will be rejected by him. And so you're probably going to end up with a situation where you have competing maps, and it's going to be decided in courts somehow.
Evers will be up for re-election in 2022. Do you know whether he intends to seek a second term? And I mean, if so, what Republicans might be looking to challenge him?
He says he has not decided whether he's going to seek a second term yet. And I think, you know, that may be the case. It's also exactly the kind of thing that a governor who did plan to seek a second term would say. So I think it's fully within the realm of possibility that he would run again for governor. If he didn't, that'd be quite a shakeup for Democrats. But right now, all he'll say is that he hasn't decided yet. As far as his potential opponents, we know that former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish is somebody who's been out there essentially running, but not running for governor already. You know, she's been very active campaigning for Republican lawmakers and speaking out for, you know, on behalf of Republican causes. You got Waukesha County Executive Paul Farrow is one of the candidates who's talked about running. You have former U.S. Senate candidate Kevin Nicholson is another candidate, as well as Eric Hovde, who ran for the U.S. Senate in 2012. So Republicans are kind of lining up there. Evers is going to be considered the Democratic candidate unless he were to bow out, in which case everything would shake up.
Sean, I suspect we'll be talking to you a lot more in 2021. Thank you so much for catching us up on things.
Thanks, Keely.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. We talked to them about Governor Evers' priorities, including the statewide mask mandates, dealing with COVID-19, the upcoming state budget, and we also talked about potential challengers as we look at running for governor in 2022. Coming up, we'll talk about the shame around COVID-19 and how empathy can advance public health. Have you tested positive for the coronavirus? How did people react when you let them know? Did you feel embarrassed? Share your story to help other people. You can do that now. Call 800-642-1234 or email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org as we start the conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Public health officials advised against traveling to see family and friends for fall and winter holidays. And for people who decided to travel anyway, there was some shame, some guilt associated with that. People wondered, why would someone take an easily unavoidable risk? Why aren't they thinking about the health and safety of others? But it's not that simple. And these are just part of the narrative of shaming around the time and place in the pandemic. We want to hear from you as we broach this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. Have you felt shame for choices you've made around wearing a mask or traveling or seeing friends and family? Do you feel like there are judgments from people that are fair, or maybe you feel like they're a little bit out of line? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest now is Julia Marcus. Julie is an infectious disease epidemiologist and associate professor in the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. Julia researches HIV infection prevention and promoting sexual health. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
This shame that we're talking about that's been directed at individuals, it comes from lots of different places. Where do you see it?
I think I first started seeing the shaming during COVID back in April, actually, or maybe even as early as March, around the time of spring break, when college students started to go travel down to Florida, and then people started to emerge from their homes more as stay-at-home orders started to lift. I think I saw it first on social media, but then started to see it in news media as well, with all these photos of crowded beaches and from health professionals as well and elected officials. So I think it's persisted since then, and in some ways I think has gotten worse, and especially in these last couple of months as cases are increasing across the U.S. I think with that increase in fear and a sense of urgency, that can also translate into more judgment and shaming of others for their choices.
What do you think the intent is here?
Well, I think first I will say judgment of others for taking risks, either risking their own lives or the lives of those around them, that judgment is totally understandable. People are angry, and they're angry for a lot of reasons right now. It's not just anger about people who are, you know, having gatherings that they don't need to be having, but also anger about the ways that our leaders have failed us. And that anger often gets directed toward individuals, because that's what we see. And we see these stories in the media about people traveling, and we hear from friends and family that that's what they're doing. And I think that the goal, in a way, of shaming is an expression of that frustration. And it gives us a sense of control in a situation that's very uncertain. And, you know, it feels like, all right, I'm going to put the locus of control on you, and now I feel better. But the problem is that shaming is not an effective public health strategy. And I can tell you this as an HIV researcher, but you can also hear it from other areas of public health, substance use, obesity. It's not a way to get people to change their behavior, and it can actually be counterproductive to the goal of reducing infections.
Why is that? Why is it counterproductive?
Well, what shaming tends to do is make people feel terrible if they actually get infected, or terrible for the choices that they're making that may involve some risk taking. Even if they're being careful, even if they have really, well thought out reasons for taking those risks. We are all taking risks in some way every day right now, some more than others, and for different reasons. But human lives are messy, and there are many reasons behind risk taking, often reflecting unmet needs around getting a paycheck, needing to go to work. There are a multitude of reasons, but the problem is that when we shame people, they feel bad about themselves, and they fear judgment, and they feel stigmatized, and they will then try to avoid disclosing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They will disclose behaviors. They won't disclose symptoms. They won't tell people if they may have exposed them for fear of judgment, and they won't engage with contact tracers. And so you can see how that ends up driving the pandemic more underground in a way that makes it much harder to address.
Julia Marcus is an infectious disease epidemiologist, and we're talking about COVID-19 and public health and the shame that comes with our discussions about it, and also comes with having a diagnosis and feeling embarrassed. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, and Samantha in Superior wants to join the conversation. Good afternoon, Samantha.
Hi. So my experience with shame around COVID is I had a positive COVID test, and I did not get any backlash from my family or friends, but who was concerned was my employer, especially when I applied for unemployment for the few weeks I had to be in quarantine. I got a couple text messages from them asking me if I really needed to be on unemployment. They were very, they asked me multiple times to prove that I tested positive, even after I already provided information. They asked me if I could come back earlier than after my fever went down, even though I still could be contagious. So it was just really like daunting to see how my employer was willing to risk everyone's safety over either unemployment or getting me back on the schedule.
Hmm. Samantha, I'm sorry to hear that, and I'm grateful that you're doing well after a bout with COVID-19. Julia, what do you hear there that other people can take away from Samantha's experience?
Well, it's interesting because first I'll say I'm sorry to hear that that happened, but I think that Samantha's experience reflects to some extent some stigma around infection, but it also reflects something much bigger that's going on here, which is what I was referring to before around people's unmet needs. People need to be able to go to work. And if they can't go to work because they're sick, they really need support in staying home. And so what I would want to hear is that an employer is doing everything they can to ensure that somebody is supported in isolating until they are no longer infectious. And we want to actually make it as easy as possible for people to do that, to quarantine, to isolate, to socially distance, to wear masks, all these things. We can't just tell people, do this, you're on your own. It's do this, and here's how we're going to support you.
You know, I've heard stories from friends or family members of mine where, you know, they've been really, really careful, and then they meet up with someone else who has been really, really careful because they haven't seen them in a long time, and they're kind of part of the same bubble, and they still encounter some shame from people for those behaviors, other people deciding that that was unsafe, even though they've tried their best at that. You write that people should be directing outrage toward institutional deficiencies as opposed to at individual people. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's easy to get really outraged when we hear about people having parties, you know, getting together and having a good time and doing things that seem like easily avoidable risks. And I think, you know, that's the, again, that judgment is understandable. That anger is understandable. But I think where that anger would be more productively directed is toward the leaders who actually have the ability to enact policies that will make us all safer. So going back to our caller, Samantha, her situation, you know, we want to make sure that people have easy access to unemployment so they can stay home. Imagine if she said, okay, I guess I will come back to work while I'm still infectious because I'm being pressured into it. Or people who don't have paid sick leave. Those are the things we need to be directing our outrage toward, you know, getting leaders to take some action, especially in ways that will protect people who are marginalized, who don't have a voice, who really are, as we can see from the socioeconomic and racial and ethnic disparities in infections in this pandemic, really are at the highest risk.
What advice do you have for us as we talk with one another about these things and as those judgments pop into our head, but then we need to talk about them in a way that's productive and that doesn't involve that kind of shame?
I think to the extent that we as not just health professionals, but people, you know, anybody in the public can try to approach this with compassion, we will get further. Understanding that everyone is struggling in some way right now. Everyone has some need that's not being met, whether it's, you know, an economic need, a need to see loved ones, a need for just having a good time in life and spontaneity and all the things that make life fun and worth living. And I think when we can take a step back and ask, why is this person taking risks? We often come to a conclusion that they're experiencing something similar to what we're experiencing or something that we can at least understand. And that becomes a place of shared ground where you can have a more productive conversation.
And what if you're on the receiving end of that shame, that someone has embarrassed you? What's a healthy way that you can kind of process what you're hearing?
Oh, that's tough. And that for that one, I'm gonna refer out to a psychologist. But I think just understanding that we are in a situation where we're all faced with risks every day. We cannot be entirely isolated. And this is a highly contagious virus. And so if you get a positive test and somebody says, how did you do this? Like, what did you do wrong? Remember that you're just living your life. And maybe you Maybe you did take more risks than you needed to take, but none of this is about a sign of bad character. The virus is not a moral agent. Getting infected is not a personal failure. Hmm.
Julia, thank you for breaking this down for us today.
Thanks for having me.
Julia Marcus is an infectious disease epidemiologist and an associate professor in the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. And we talked with her today about how shaming people about having or risking spreading COVID-19 can actually be counterproductive to the goal of stopping the pandemic. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.